Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. We're a nation of immigrants, but throughout our history, that has not prevented hostility to those who come. African Americans were brought to our shores, unwilling immigrants forced into slave labor. Yet for more than a century after emancipation, they were subjected to fierce repression and discrimination. Chinese workers came to build our Western railroads, then were prohibited from owning property. And for the last half century or more, Hispanics have come to work in low-paying jobs. Many came or stayed illegally. And the number of undocumented immigrants in our nation now is over 10 million. Perhaps 4,000 of them live in Montana, roughly one-half of 1% of our population. In November, Montanans overwhelmingly passed LR 121, which will deny significant state services to these undocumented state residents. Shahid Hawk Housegraff is a lawyer serving this population. He is also executive director of MIHA, the Montana Immigrant Justice Alliance. Shahid, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for having me.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Midwest. I was born in Georgia. My parents are both immigrants from Pakistan, and my father came to the United States as a doctor to serve an underserved community that was in special need of doctors, and that's how he came into the United States on a visa. I was born in Georgia, but we moved to Indiana and ultimately Illinois and found my way to Montana through my wife.
And your dad, how did he end up coming here to serve in a low-income or needy population? How did that happen?
He got a visa that was a particular type of visa that existed at the time. And this type of visa was available specifically for doctors who would be willing to live in certain parts of the United States that didn't have enough doctors. And so it was geared towards bringing in a particular type of professional that we needed. And a lot of our immigration policies are directed towards bringing certain people into the country that provide something that we need.
I didn't know that. I've heard the controversy in the immigration debate about, let's say, computer specialists and industry saying that rules need to be changed to encourage immigration and enable immigration on a sort of selective basis, which made me conclude, apparently erroneously, that we didn't have that sort of provision like your dad benefited from and we benefited from his coming. So it sounds like I'm wrong, but you say there's a lot of those kind of things.
There are visas available typically for only the highest caliber of employee or professional. Even today, visas are still relatively readily available for people who possess a graduate degree or higher. But the problem is that visas for employment are very restricted for anyone possessing less than a graduate degree. And that's the majority of the world population.
How about your mom? Tell us a little about her.
My mom was born in Pakistan, and she is a homemaker here in the United States. And both my parents now live in St. Louis.
Your dad still practices medicine?
Yeah, he actually works at a VA clinic in St. Louis.
And how about your education?
I went to college and the University of Southern Indiana, and then I went to law school at the Chicago College of Law in Chicago, Illinois.
Why law?
I started getting into the law primarily so that I could use my talents, I suppose, to do something productive. I've always been, I guess, a little bit of a devil's advocate, a little bit of an arguer, and this was the way that I could actually put that to
Well, that's an interesting definition, because some people might say devil's advocate and arguer might not fit the definition of productive. So you obviously differed. What did you figure to do with it? Were you just interested in arguments or particular types of arguments?
I was more interested in particular types of arguments. The year I graduated from college was the year that September 11th occurred, and that ultimately created it brought up a lot of different issues that I was experiencing at the time. And I think that as a Muslim growing up in Indiana, one of only a few, I noticed that there were some misconceptions that were being applied to myself and my colleagues. And, you know, the idea that we needed to look more critically about perceptions and misconceptions kind of spurred my idea to help certain other communities, including immigrant communities. My parents were immigrants, and although I was born here in the United States and I'm a natural-born citizen, there are misconceptions about people's citizenship, different, you know.
You really sound to me like you're being tactful.
Maybe I am being a little tactful.
So be frank with me. What are we talking about?
Well, racial profiling is a pretty significant concern for members of any immigrant community. I experienced that growing up myself.
Okay, let me just get a little timeline here. September 11th, 2001, you're how old?
I guess I'm about 21 years old.
Maybe. Okay, so you're not in law school yet, or you are? No, you're an undergrad.
Not yet. I just graduated from undergrad.
So did anything particular happen to you? Obviously, there was a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment. There were attacks on Muslims. There was a lot of talk, okay, a lot of fear. I remember people here in Montana telling me they were concerned about secret Muslim cells all across the country. These were people I knew well, I would say sober people. A lot of that went on. What did you experience personally, and did it influence your decision regarding law and the direction of your legal career?
I think it did. You know, I experienced a lot of minor stuff, a lot of small things, but a lot of things also that gave me a perspective of what others might be dealing with in the immigrant community, what others in the Latino or Hispanic community might be dealing with as well. And one example is, I went to Walmart one time to print out some pictures. I printed out some pictures of my grandfather. Some of them had writing on them because they were really old pictures. The clerk at Walmart wouldn't let me purchase the pictures because she said she wasn't sure if some of that writing might contain hidden terrorist language that that could be used to put the United States at risk. Things like that. You would never imagine that would happen to anyone else, but certain segments of the population, when they are being perceived as something other than the rest of us, they're being marginalized or disenfranchised, treated as an other rather than a part of your community. You never know. Things happen to those segments of the population that don't happen to the rest. And that intrigued me and I think stuck with me, that concept that our world and experiences, our lived experiences may not be representative because we haven't lived the same life as others.
Let's just pursue this a little bit. I can absolutely appreciate how the experience with those family photographs would be very disturbing to you. At the same time, I go back, I grew up at a period after World War II. It was fresh in the community's recollection at the time. And the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Japanese Americans, citizens of the United States, ended up being interned for years in prison camps. From your side, and actually from my side, that seemed to me as a child a terrible injustice. At the same time, it seemed to me fully understandable in terms of a fear-based reaction in a wartime situation. Did that aspect, that is the, when you looked at the Walmart clerk, did you see somebody that you felt was simply racially prejudiced, was crazy, or could you understand at the time why in the aftermath of 9/11 they would feel that fear?
I think it's understandable why after 9/11 there might be fear. I don't look at things on an individual level and think that the problems associated with racial profiling prejudice or even the problems associated with kind of anti-immigrant sentiment is because we're dealing with bad people. No, I actually look at it from a standpoint of we need to ensure that we have policies that protect against those types of harms that are associated with racial profiling, with other forms of prejudice. Though understandable, they are incorrect and damaging to our communities. And so I look at it more from a policy perspective.
You're listening to Home Ground, and we are talking with Shahid Hawk Hausgraf, a lawyer serving the immigrant community and executive director of MIHA, the Montana Immigrant Justice Alliance. So it seems fairly clear to me that that experience cumulatively influenced your choice of what you did with your law degree.
That's fair.
In a nutshell, how you end up in Montana?
My wife went to the University of Montana in Missoula for her undergraduate degree, and it really stuck with her. She loved Montana. And she convinced me. We met in law school in Chicago, and she told me all about how great it would be to live here in the state of Montana. And I believed her, and I'm glad I did. We moved over here about 5 years ago, and I started my law practice pretty shortly afterwards, and I've never looked back.
What does she do?
My wife is a Helena City Commissioner, and she also works for the Department of Environmental Quality in the Remediation Division as an attorney there.
I don't watch the City Commission too often, but I have been impressed with a bright young woman. That's got to be your wife.
That is. Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about your practice. Coming to Montana, did you come to practice what I'll call immigrant law?
I didn't come specifically to practice immigration law. You know, in Chicago, I was doing pro bono cases on behalf of refugees who had come to the United States to seek asylum on account of racial persecution, prejudice, or on account of their expression of their political beliefs. And so I represented clients from Eritrea, which is a country that neighbors Ethiopia, the Ivory Coast. I represented some clients from Zimbabwe and a few other countries. And those cases really stuck with me. It made an impression on me that these were people who were escaping persecution and death in their home countries. And they fled to the United States very literally, sometimes using fake immigration documents, sometimes using real immigration documents that didn't allow mm-hmm. them to stay here permanently. But upon entering the United States, they requested political asylum here in our country.
And that's a provision of federal law that would enable them to be here.
Yes, if it's granted, and that's a big if. Asylum is a very difficult form of relief to win. There are some misconceptions sometimes that we have hordes of refugees who simply state their claim to asylum and then get to stay here. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's not true at all. The asylum process is so difficult that in order to effectively make your case for why you should be granted political asylum, you really need an attorney. And what the statistics show are that the vast majority of applicants who do not have attorneys are denied. And the vast majority who do are approved. That's not because the attorneys are so great or anything of that nature. It's because our government is designed to review cases in a very analytical manner, and they're looking for a very specific presentation. And all the attorney does in these cases typically is facilitate the story and make sure that all of the important elements of their life and why they had to flee their home country is being presented. Mm-hmm. And when that's done, the cases are far more likely to be approved.
Would you say then that the governmental review process, provided someone has a competent representative, is fair?
I don't think it's always fair. One reason that the asylum process is not particularly fair is that there's a one-year filing deadline. Oftentimes, people come into the United States on a temporary visa. They did flee their country to escape persecution or death, but upon entering, they didn't need to immediately apply for asylum because they had some time available to them. They may have been here on a student visa that gave them 3 or 4 years before they had to return to their home country. They didn't get around to it.
Okay, but with that aside, is the review process fair in your experience?
I would say that oftentimes the review process is not fair. The reason is because it tends to assume that people are going to act in a very rational, analytical manner when humans who are escaping persecution and abuse don't necessarily do that. They don't necessarily bring every shred of documentation that's going to prove the abuse that they experienced in their home country, because sometimes they're just fleeing their home country and need to escape for their life. They may not remember precise dates, but even the most minuscule of discrepancies in the dates of occurrences will result in a denial of your application. So there are definitely some inequities in the process.
Let's talk about this organization you founded, MEHA. What's its mission?
MEHA's mission is to encourage broader civic engagement and participation by our immigrant communities here in Montana, also to encourage more immigrants to become naturalized citizens when that option's available to them, to explain to immigrants what rights they have, because there are violations of their rights, and we know that immigrant communities that are somewhat marginalized are not very likely to assert their legal rights, and those rights are being violated more often. But also we want to combat harmful laws and policies in the state of Montana and encourage better ones.
Let's talk about rights. If people are here legally, they have what rights as distinctive from American citizens? Are there any rights they don't have? I assume they don't have the right to vote, for example, if they're a legal immigrant. But do they have the right to send their children to school? Do they have the right to emergency medical care? Do they have the right to scholarships? Help us understand the status of legal immigrants.
Well, the U.S. Constitution actually says very little about denying rights to anyone. It refers to due process and other protections being afforded to all persons. And the U.S. Supreme Court has considered that to mean that all people are entitled to due process protections.
Citizen or not?
Citizen or not.
Okay.
There are some restrictions. Obviously, only U.S. citizens can vote. Permanent residents can't vote, and nor can temporary visitors or undocumented immigrants. But all immigrant children are entitled to a primary education, and that cannot be denied. But the rights and privileges that immigrants have in the state of Montana have recently been called into question by LR 121, the referendum that Montanans voted on this past election cycle, and this referendum passed.
LR 121 was aimed to deny undocumented, therefore, quote unquote, illegal immigrants from certain state services. My question to you is very specifically, what are the rights of legal immigrants? Now, I got the answer. I think I understand the answer. Substantially the same rights, with some exceptions, as American citizens enjoy. So now what rights do, before 121 passes, in the United States of America, under federal law, in other words, leaving out Montana as a separate entity for the moment, what rights do and do not undocumented immigrants have who are here in violation of the law?
Undocumented immigrants who are here in violation of the law do not have the right under federal law to work in the United States, although many do, as we know. Undocumented immigrants do not have the right to collect food stamps or to collect really most forms of means-tested public benefits. The only exception being emergency care is not denied to anyone.
Now, is that a court decision or a public policy? If an undocumented immigrant hit by a car, broke an arm, goes to the emergency room, it's law they will be served?
That's law.
But then in terms of if it's determined they're undocumented, they can be deported afterwards? Is that part of the law or not?
That is part of the law, yes. In fact, if they are determined to be undocumented, some hospitals have been reporting that information to immigration authorities, rightly or wrongly, and oftentimes deportation is a consequence.
You're listening to Home Ground, and we are talking with Shahid Hawk Housegrath, attorney and executive director of MIHA, the Montana Immigrant Justice Alliance. So what is 121? What did 121 add to the restrictions on undocumented workers' rights and services? It sounds like they're not entitled to much already.
That's right. What LR 121 did is create new barriers for really all Montanans to access state services, because LR 121 requires for the first time that everyone carry proof of citizenship or immigration status and present those documents before accessing certain state services. One thing that does constitute a pretty dramatic change in the law is that LR 121 would deny the right to attend college to anyone who is not a citizen or permanent resident of the United States. And so undocumented immigrants oftentimes had difficulty attending college, oftentimes had difficulty getting through the admissions process. But our laws here in the state of Montana said that the university system was open to all students. That's changed now. And undocumented students, oftentimes brought here as children, go through the high school system here in the state of Montana, may graduate and ultimately go to college. That right will now be denied.
Both elementary, secondary, and higher education, all?
Actually, it cannot and doesn't in this version of the law apply to elementary or secondary education. It's just the right to attend a public university in the state of Montana.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Public education is costly. It is subsidized by the taxpayers of the state of Montana. Why should illegal residents of the state of Montana or any other state in the United States have access to an expensive, scarce state service? Why should they?
Access to university should be afforded to all residents of the state of Montana, regardless of immigration status.
Why?
One reason is because it allows you to be a more productive member of society. Immigrants, as well as citizens, have a stake in our communities. They contribute to our economy. A college degree allows you to be more productive. It allows you to benefit your community and contribute to the economy. So, you know, I don't see what societal good is being created by denying the right to attend college.
Okay, I suppose the argument would be that if you have people who are here illegally, that means there's a public policy in place to control the number and kind of people who can come legally to the United States. That's, let's say, quote-unquote, federal immigration policy. It may have numerical limits. I simply don't know. But if we assume it has some logic to it, then people who are here illegally have impacts on the community. You've pointed out beneficial impact. Most undocumented people, to my knowledge, low-income jobs, work like hell, send money back to their home country to help those their family and relative earn live a better life. The counterargument from union guys that I've talked to is it's the law of supply and demand. I came from California. You had people working in the farm, in the agricultural fields for below minimum wage, therefore having downward pressure on the wages that would be paid by documented workers and citizen workers. So there's a downside to it as well. Do you disagree with that?
You know, there's a lot that you brought up in that question. A lot of the time we're speaking to some extent in different languages.
Okay.
There's a lot of ideology and I think factual misconceptions that are built into a lot of what we debate in the debate about our immigration system. You know, one thing that you brought up is that if we were to assume that the federal laws regarding immigration restrictions were logical, in fact, that's one thing that it's not.
Why?
Well, what we have in place right now is a system that simply restricts most immigrants who would like to come into the United States legally from doing so. Unless you have family members in the United States, immediate family members who can petition for you, the ability to come into the United States is severely restricted and in some cases impossible. You're talking about wait times of over a decade, sometimes over 20 years, and for some people, flat out no possibilities to come into the United States.
Okay, so you're saying that's not logical.
That's right.
Okay, but what I would ask you is, separate from the logic and humanity of helping reunite families on one side of the equation, is the other side that unlimited immigration with the amount of poor people who exist, when I say poor, I mean poverty-stricken people south of the border, not just in Mexico but in a lot of places, would come here in uncontrolled numbers, fair? So you have to have some kind of regulation. Do you agree with that or not?
There are many that do not agree with that.
And do you?
I think that there are certain restrictions on immigration that may make sense. The problem is that we in the United States right now have, as you mentioned, over 10 million undocumented immigrants. We're not going to deport all of them, and clearly we need to come up with solutions that work. Now, what we need to do is start creating more reasonable pathways for immigrants to come into the country legally, as well as more reasonable options for immigrants to legalize their status when they're already here. That's the only way we're really going to fix the problems that are associated with undocumented immigration. Now, you mentioned that wages being depressed.
Supply and demand, more low-wage labor as downward pressure on low-wage wages.
You know, the thing that depresses wages is having a workforce that can be treated with fewer labor protections and fewer rights of redress. I think that's the real problem that drives wages down. Study after study has shown that when immigrants are provided labor protections, given work authorization, very quickly that equalizes the wages that they're willing to work for.
So in other words, let me see if I understand you. Someone who comes in here who's undocumented, employers know it, and they then are in a position to abuse on the salary level and other working conditions, safety and otherwise, the pay that they have to pay those workers, and that then is what's causing the downward pressure.
I think that's correct. Employers throughout history have always looked for what they call a secondary labor market, which is a group of people who can be treated with less protections, less rights and privileges, so that they can pay lower wages to these workers. And that has included children, women, other groups. Obviously, slavery is an extreme example of a secondary labor market. But undocumented immigrants are a certain form of undocumented labor market.
Well, we did a show with the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office that described human trafficking, and there's a lot of trafficking of undocumented people leading to forced work and basically sexual slavery in certain situations. Even, however, recognizing that there's a lot of abuse of undocumented people, a lot of people are going to say, look, illegal is illegal. If you're here illegally, you should have no rights and you ought to get out of the country or be taken out of the country. It's that simple. What do you say to that?
I would just encourage everyone to look at the humanity of the situation. Immigration has always been part of the human condition. There are things that drive people to leave their home countries and come into the United States seeking opportunities for themselves and their families. Let me give you just one example of many. I've represented clients who are in deportation proceedings who came to the United States, met U.S. citizens, started a family, had several children here in the United States, and then after 20 years of being here in the United States, putting down roots and providing for their family, they wind up in deportation proceedings. One client of mine came here from Guatemala 20 years ago. He has a child with severe developmental disabilities, and he's the sole breadwinner for his family. If he were removed, what would the United States have to gain? What would the state of Montana have to gain except for a child on hospice care that the state would have to pay for? He was an important part of his family. He was a contributing member of society. And the humanity of the situation creates more complexities than simply lawbreakers and punishing lawbreakers. I think we need to look at the idea that immigration has always been part of Montana's history. It's been an important part of our own history. Apart from our Native American population, we all ultimately are descended from immigrants who came to the United States for their own pursuit of opportunities. And I think that we need to look at our current immigrants and in the same light.
Shahid Hawk Hausgraf, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for its content. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. Contact us at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, High Stakes, Norcross, Humanities Montana, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to present and future generations of Montanans.